The head of the UN climate talks says it's a misconception that Australia is going it alone on climate change. Christiana Figueres says that while Australia has achieved a great deal at a national level, the government needs to do more if it wants to claim that it is really truly a global leader in this front. In particular, she says Australia must renew its commitment to the Kyoto Protocol. Climate treaty negotiations in Doha in December will determine the fate of the protocol, which is due to expire later this year if no new deal is struck. Christiana Figueres is currently in Australia talking to government and industry, and she's speaking with our environment editor, Greg Borschmann.
I chose to come to Australia for a couple of reasons. A, I wanted to thank the Australian government for a domestic policy that I think is going to greatly contribute to international efforts. I wanted to thank Australian government for always having a very clear leadership role in the international intergovernmental negotiations. That is not something now, but it's been a tradition for many years of the Australian government.
Yesterday you described Australia as, hopefully, an emerging leader on this issue. That was qualified, and the direct quote from you was, "You are definitely not leading the world. I would love you to lead the world, but that's not true," unquote. What did you mean?
Australia has taken its clean energy future package on board from a national perspective. But the challenge that Australia now has is how do they reflect that at the international level? And that is the step that Australia needs to decide if it's going to do it, how it's going to do it, when it's going to do it.
What are you talking about here? Are you talking about a second commitment period for Kyoto, which Australia has currently refused to sign up for?
It is my understanding that Australia has not refused to sign up for it. It is my understanding that the Australian government is currently considering whether they will enter into the second commitment period, if so, how they would do it and when they would do it.
And what difference would that make to the world if Australia said tomorrow, yes, we will sign up for a second commitment period for Kyoto? How would the rest of the world see that?
You know, it does make a big difference because currently the other countries that have confirmed their participation in the second commitment period are all European continent-based countries. And hence, just from a geographical coverage perspective, it would be very important to have Australia there. Secondly, what is very important is to set the example of how national policy that has a clear carbon price can be made to be coherent and vertically integrated all the way from the national up to the international and then down to community levels. And Australia has the opportunity to show the world how that is done.
Is the Kyoto Protocol in fact doomed as long as the Americans remain outside the tent, even with their voluntary pledge to cut emissions by 17% by 2020?
No, the United States made a decision way back in the beginning of Kyoto that they would not join, and the protocol has proceeded without the United States. All countries are on track to meet their Kyoto Protocol commitments, and more importantly than that, all countries have abided with a set of rules that have given a very clear environmental integrity to the global effort to mitigate emissions.
Of course, the problem is that the world has committed to action to try to limit global warming to 2 degrees, but the pledges currently on the table do not add up. Emissions are continuing to rise exponentially, and there is no sign that they will indeed peak and decline anytime soon. This is a road crash waiting to happen, isn't it?
The pledges that are on the table represent only 60% of the global effort that is necessary to get to the 2-degree maximum temperature rise target. It is clear governments cannot do this on their own. If I may use a visual image, think of the governments as being the captains on a very large boat, the course of which they need to change. And they have changed that. They have chartered a new course. They have said we have to get to a maximum of 2 degrees, in fact, maybe even 1.5. But the motors down in the engine room, that's not the governments. The motors down in the engine room is basically the private sector and to a certain extent civil society. So that is why that collaboration between all three, among all three sectors, is absolutely critical, not just to keep the course, but actually to increase the speed of change.
How much is the core issue a carbon budget? For example, Australia is the highest per capita emitter of all countries.
No, it's the highest per capita emitter of all developed countries.
Right, but that obviously has to change. I mean, 550 Australians out of every 1,000 own a motor car. Only 35 out of every 1,000 Chinese people currently own a motor car. That's unfair as far as the Chinese see it, surely. That's what they'd be telling you, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. But that is why developing countries need to be able, in this case transportation, they need to be able to access the transportation that they need for their economic growth, but they need to do it in a low carbon fashion. And that is why it is so important to provide developing countries with both finance and low carbon clean energy technologies so that they will be able to make that leapfrog.
Australia is the world's 15th biggest polluter. And it proposes to double its export of carbon pollution over the next decade with a huge expansion of its coal sector. Is this simply Australia keeping the benefits of the mining boom, but offshoring the environmental costs?
Well, the fact is that the current policy in Australia is actually calling for emission reductions. So Australia has assumed the responsibility of joining the rest of countries, in particular developed countries, and beginning to curb their growth in emissions.
I understand that, but Australia takes no responsibility for the climate impact of its coal exports. The climate still gets the emissions. Australia may not, but the climate still gets them.
Well, that is true, and that is why it is very important that all countries work together. That is why it is absolutely critical for countries to pursue what they have already promised each other, which is a 2015 climate agreement that will be applicable to all.
There were huge expectations 3 years ago at Copenhagen. You've said that those negotiations collapsed, at least partly for that reason. Is it your job to keep the bar as low as possible for the next round of talks later this year in Doha?
You know, I am ever grateful for the negotiations in Copenhagen for two reasons. A, they delivered a set of pledges upon which countries continue to build. They delivered a structure that has actually been the backbone of the negotiations over the past 3 years, and countries have actually followed that backbone to deliver on the huge amount of support and structure that is in place now. And at the same time, I must say, Copenhagen did end with the world being in what I call a bad mood about climate. But I sense that governments have changed that approach, that they now come to the climate conferences in much more of a good mood with respect to working with each other, fully well understanding that they still have differences that they have to bridge, but in a much more collaborative and cooperative manner because they realize the time is not on their side.
That's Cristina Figueres, Executive Secretary of UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, speaking with Greg Borschmann there, our environment editor. She met with, Cristina Figueres met with the Climate Change Minister, Greg Combe, in Canberra yesterday on this whole issue of Australia's position on Kyoto Mark II. There seems there were no guarantees. After those talks, the Minister's office simply described it as a productive meeting. It's 4 minutes to 8 on Breakfast.